That was the thing. 2 weeks before Simon graduated, Dad died of a massive coronary while he was driving to a job in Milburn, New Jersey. It had been a devastating blow to Simon's family, the beginning of the end in many ways. When Simon started to have children of his own, he would try to remember how his own father had done it, like an apprentice trying to study the master, but he always felt as though he was falling short. Did Simon's children love their father as much as Simon had loved his? Did they respect him like that? Did Simon make them feel that kind of safe? And mostly, would his father have taken his eye off the ball and let his daughter become a junkie? Would he have stood by idly while his wife got shot? Those were the thoughts that haunted Simon as he stepped on the campus where he'd spent 4 years. Students hurried by him, mostly with their heads down. He could make the standard whining observation about how the youngsters were all staring at their little screen or had headphones jammed into their ears, how they all wanted to shut out the world so that they could be surrounded by people and yet completely alone. But his generation was just as bad, so what was the point? Simon spotted the bronze statue of Athena, the Greek goddess of wisdom, sitting on her throne. If you looked closely, Simon knew, you could find a tiny owl hidden in her cloak by her left leg. Legend had it that the first member of an incoming class to find the owl became the valedictorian. Athena's left arm is outstretched, purportedly to welcome visitors, but Simon sometimes saw it as more like his grandmother's shrug gesture when she'd say, "Eh, what can you do about it?" His mobile rang again. The caller ID told him it was Elena Ramirez. "Anything new?" he asked. "Yeah, a lot." Elena hit only briefly on the actual reasons she'd gone to Maine, just to say that something was clearly fishy with the adoptions. She concentrated instead on what her tech guy had helped her discover about the DNA genealogy. Simon moved up the steps of Low Library. He half sat, half collapsed on the cool marble, and listened as Elena ran through what she had learned. The adoptions, the half-brothers on the DNA website, the sudden deaths. "Someone is killing them off," Simon said at one point. "It seems so, yes." He wasn't sure what he felt when she told him that Paige, who had signed up for the same DNA genealogy test, was not a blood relative. It should have been a comfort. Did it mean that he was indeed the father? But then a thought occurred to him. "We don't know for sure," he said. "Don't know what for sure, Simon?" "That Paige isn't a half-sibling, too." "How so?" "Maybe Paige didn't list her real name. I read about a few cases where people put in other people's DNA or fake names or whatever. So maybe she's that other sibling, the one with initials." "N.B.? Right." "No, Simon, that can't be." "Why not?" "He's listed as a male. If Paige put her own DNA in here, even if she used a fake name, they'd know if the DNA sample came from a male or a female. This was from a male, so N.B. can't be Paige."
"So maybe she used another pseudonym."
"Maybe. But we now control Henry Thorpe's page. It lists all his relatives. There are no female relatives who are closer than a third cousin."
"So I still don't get it. How is Paige involved?"
"Through Aaron, somehow. But I don't know. Maybe we've been looking at it the wrong way."
"How so?"
"Maybe your daughter put someone else's DNA in instead of her own."
"I thought about that, but why?"
"I don't know. We need to track down her movements. Maybe Paige discovered something, a crime or something that made no sense, something that led her to Aaron."
Simon thought about it. "Let's take a step back and see what we know for sure."
"Yeah, okay.
First off, all of these men came from the same biological father."
"Right."
"They were all probably adopted out of the same small agency in Maine."
"Right."
"And there was some kind of cover-up. The father's name isn't listed on the adoption reports."
"As far as we know right now, yeah," Elena said.
Simon switched the phone from his right hand to his left.
"Have you read about those cases where an infertility doctor ends up using his own semen to impregnate his patients? There was one case in Indiana, I think, where a woman found 8 unknown siblings on one of these DNA sites, sort of like what you're saying here, and then the siblings all got together and figured out the infertility doctor had been using his own sperm and pretending it came from a bank or something.
Yeah, I remember, Elena said. There are a number of cases like that, a big one in Utah, Canada, too.
You sound skeptical.
I just don't see how it would work here. The women in those cases weren't giving up the babies for adoption. They wanted them more than anything.
She had a point. We're still missing something, he said.
Agree. So I'm going to take another run at Allison Mayflower, because she's the one who set up the adoptions. I'm going to threaten her with prison, whatever it takes. I also want to try to get the FBI interested, but I'll have to do that through a backdoor channel.
Why?
All the info I just gave you, you can't tell anyone. Someone could claim that it was obtained illegally, the fruits of a bad act or some such thing. Either way, if we go to the feds today, it won't be a priority. It'll take days, probably weeks, just to get it assigned to someone. We don't have...
There was a pause.
Simon, hold on, I have another call.
Simon's eyes drifted across the campus. He remembered something that had impressed his father during the tour. The main campus, where Simon now sat on these steps, across College Walk where he'd entered, then past the South Fields, was bookended by Lowe Library and Butler Library.
2 libraries, Simon, his father had said with a shake of his head. What better symbol of learning?
Odd thought to conjure up right now, but it was keeping Simon from allowing a bigger, uglier one to consume him. Even if he could figure out what was going on with these half-brothers and adoptions, how could that help him find Paige?
Elena came back on the line. Simon?
A man hurried past him on the steps on his way, no doubt, to the alma mater statue. Simon recognized the face from his online profile, Professor Louis Vandebeek. With the phone still against his ear, Simon stood to follow.
Yeah, what's up? He said.
Gotta go. Allison Mayflower wants to meet.
Chapter 30 Ash parked the car behind the house. You couldn't see the car from the road, but Dee Dee still stood guard, just in case someone made the turn into the long driveway. Ash checked the back of the car. The bags were all there. He unzipped them and laid the weapons across the back seat. All present and accounted for. He grabbed what he needed, put the other weapons back in the bag, and whistled with 2 fingers. When Dee Dee came back, he handed her an FN 5.7.
You had time to think, he said.
About?
Mother Adiona's note. First off, who is she?
She serves in the chamber. That's as high up as any woman can go.
Do you think she's loyal to your cult?
Don't call it a cult, Dee Dee said, and yes, there is only one other mother who is known as Mother Abiona, and they both were of such pure truth that they were the ones he chose to create, the visitor and the volunteer.
So Vardage's kids, he said. They're only half-brothers.
Yes.
And which one is Mother Adiona's son?
The volunteer.
So Mother Adiona is the volunteer's mother, and Mother Abiona is the visitor's mother.
Yes. They started toward the back of the house. Why do you care, Ash?
I don't. But I don't like having someone on the inside working against us. Do you?
I didn't really think of it that way.
Mother Adiona had someone torture me to find out what we were up to. Then she slipped me a note telling me not to do it. That doesn't worry you at all?
Oh, it worries me, she said.
Ash checked the surroundings. Dee Dee.
Yes?
Why do I think you're not telling me everything?
She smiled and faced him full on. Ash felt his heart pick up the pace. You felt it, didn't you? When you were with him.
Vartage is charismatic, I'll give you that.
And Truth Haven?
It's peaceful and quiet, he agreed.
It's more than that. It's serene.
So?
You remember what I was like before.
He did. A mess. But it hadn't been her fault. Too many foster fathers and teachers and guidance counselors and spiritual advisors, especially the most sanctimonious of them,
could not keep their hands and impure thoughts away from her.
I remember, he said.
Don't I seem better, Ash?
You do.
The sun was in his eyes, and he wanted to keep looking at her, so he placed his hand on his forehead, half salute, half visor.
But it doesn't have to be either or.
For me, it does.
We can run away.
He heard something unfamiliar in his voice now. Desperation, longing.
I can find us a place, a peaceful place like your haven, quiet, serene.
We could do that, she said. But it wouldn't stick.
He started to say more, but she put a silencing finger to his lips.
The real world holds too many temptations for me, Ash. Even being out here now with you, I need to focus, be disciplined, or I'll get hooked again. I'll fall. And I need more.
More?
Yes.
And blindly believing in this truth nonsense gives you more?
Oh, I don't believe in it.
Wait, what?
Most religious people don't believe the dogma, Ash. We take from it what we want, we discard what we don't. We form whatever narrative we like. Kind God, vengeful God, active God, laid-back God, whatever. We just make sure we get something out of it. Maybe we get life everlasting while people we resent burn for eternity. Maybe we get something more concrete, money, a job, friends. You just change the narrative.
I'm surprised to hear that, Ash said.
Really?
He cupped both hands around the back window so he could peer into the kitchen. Empty. Lights out. More than that, the kitchen table was covered in a long white cloth, the kind of thing you put on when you're closing up for the season.
Dee Dee said, when the truth traveled to Arizona to find that hidden symbol in the desert, the symbol that is the entire basis for our belief in one truth, do you know what future it foretold?
Ash turned away from the window.
When the current embodiment of the truth dies and ascends to the second level, he would be replaced not by men, but the truth would be unified and strengthened by two people representing all of humanity, a man, and joining him a woman, a special woman. Dee Dee grinned.
Ash looked at her. You.
She spread her arms to indicate that he was correct.
And the symbol really foretold this? The stuff about a man and now a woman?
No, of course not, Ash.
He made a face indicating he didn't understand.
This is a recent, Dee Dee made quote marks with her hand, interpretation.
So, you know, Ash said.
Know what?
You know it's all nonsense.
No, Ash. You don't get it. Like everyone else, I get what I need to out of it. It nourishes me. Knowing it isn't literal doesn't make my beliefs a less potent force. It makes them stronger. It puts me in control.
Or in other words, Ash said, you figured an angle to become ruler.
That's your perspective. You're entitled to it.
Dee Dee checked the time.
Come on, it's almost time.
She started up the hill. Ash followed. These jobs of ours, he said, they encouraged the truth to form his new, interpretation in your favor, didn't they?
Dee Dee kept walking. God isn't the only one who works in mysterious ways.
Simon said, Professor Van de Beek,
please call me Lewis.
Van de Beek looked like his bio page, young, pretty boyish, waxy, toned. He wore the tight black t-shirt, too, just as he had in the online photograph. His gaze flitted away as they shook hands, but he flashed a smile anyway, one Simon couldn't help but think uncharitably, that worked on wooing your co-eds, like his daughter, maybe. Or was such a thought sexist?
I'm really sorry about Paige, Van de Beek said.
In what way?
Pardon?
You said you were sorry. Sorry about what?
Didn't you say on the phone she was missing?
And that's what you're sorry about, Lewis? The man cringed at the tone,
and Simon cursed himself for being too aggressive.
My apologies, Simon said in a far more genteel voice. It's just... my wife's been shot. Paige's mother.
What? Oh, that's awful. Is she...
in a coma. The color ebbed from his face.
Hi, Lewis!
Two students, both male, for the record, had spotted him on their way up the low library steps. They stopped to be acknowledged, but their greeting hadn't registered. The other student said, Lewis? Simon hated when people called professors by their first name. Van de Beek snapped out of whatever trance he'd put him into.
Oh, hi, Jeremy. Hi, Daryl.
He smiled at them, but the bright bulb behind it was seriously flickering. The students sheepishly continued on their way. You wanted to tell me something, Simon prompted.
What? No, you left me messages.
Yes, and when you called back, it was clear you had something you wanted to say.
Van de Beek started gnawing on his lower lip.
Simon added, you were Paige's favorite professor. She trusted you. This was, at best, third-hand information, but it was probably accurate and, at the very least, flattering.
Paige was a wonderful student, he said. The kind that we professors think about when we grow up wanting to teach.
It felt like a line he'd said plenty of times in the past, but it also sounded like he meant it.
So what happened? Simon asked.
I don't know. I sent you a bright, inquisitive young woman. It was her first time on her own, away from the only home and family she'd ever known.
Simon felt something rise in him, something he couldn't quite describe, a blend of rage, sadness, regret, paternal love.
I trusted you to watch out for her.
We try, Mr. Green,
and failed.
You don't know that.
But if you're here to spread blame, I'm not.
I'm here because I need to find her, please.
I don't know where she is.
Tell me what you remember.
He looked down from their perch above the commons.
Let's walk, Van de Beek said. It's too weird just standing on these steps like this.
He started down them. Simon stayed by his side.
Like I said, Paige was a good student, he began, super engaged. A lot of kids come in that way, of course. They're almost too fired up. They want to take advantage of every opportunity, and they start burning the candle at both ends. Do you remember your undergraduate years?
Simon nodded. I do.
Where did you go, if I can ask?
Here. Columbia.
They crossed over College Walk toward Butler Library.
Did you know what you wanted to be when you arrived?
Not a clue. I started off in engineering.
People say college opens the world to you. In some ways, of course, that's true, but for the most part, it does the opposite. You come in thinking you can do anything when you leave. Your options are endless. Point of fact, though, your options dwindle every day you're here. By the time you graduate, again, reality has splash landed.
What does this have to do with Paige? He asked.
He stared off, a smile on his lips.
She did all that quickly, but in the best way. She found her calling, genetics. She wanted to be a doctor, a healer, like her mother. She knew that within weeks. She started coming to office hours as often as I'd let her. She wanted to know what tracks to take to become my TA. I thought she was doing really well. And then something changed.
What? He kept walking.
There are rules, Mr. Green. I need you to understand that, about what we can tell parents of students. If a student asks for confidentiality, we have to give it to them, up to a limit. Are you familiar with the campus rules on Title IX?
Simon's blood froze.
Eileen Vaughn had said something when he'd visited her at Lanford, something about how Paige and Eileen's mutual friend Judy Ziskind suspected Paige had been the victim of a sexual assault at a frat party. Simon had sort of blocked on that, because one, it was too awful to even consider, but two, more importantly, Paige had dismissed it when Judy confronted her about it. That was the part that had stuck with Simon. Judy had pushed Paige, and according to Eileen, Paige had not only denied it, but finally ended the conversation. She said there were problems at home. They veered off the path and reached the glass-enclosed structure called Lerner Hall. There was a cafe on the bottom floor. Van de Beek reached for the door, but Simon grabbed hold of his elbow. Was my daughter sexually assaulted? He asked.
I think so.
Think so?
Paige came to me in confidence. She was distraught. There had been an incident at a campus party.
Simon felt his hands tighten into fists. She told you about it?
She started to, yes.
What does that mean, started to?
The first thing I did, before I let her go into details, was to inform her that I'd have to follow the Title IX guidelines.
What guidelines?
Mandatory reporting, he said.
Meaning?
If a student tells me about an incident of sexual assault, no matter what the student wants, I have to report it to the Title IX coordinator.
Even if the victim doesn't want you to?
Even if, that's right. Frankly, I don't love this rule. I get it. I understand the reasoning. But I think it makes some students less likely to confide in a teacher because they know, like it or not, that the teacher will have to report it, so they clam up. And that was what happened here.
Paige wouldn't talk to you?
She more or less stormed out. I tried to follow, but she ran away. I called, I texted, I emailed. I stopped by her room once. She wouldn't talk to me.
Simon felt his fingers tighten up a little more. And you didn't think to tell her parents?
I thought about it, sure. But again, there are rules about such things. I also checked with the Title IX coordinator.
What did she say?
It was a he.
For real? What did he say?
He talked to Paige. She denied anything happened.
And you still didn't think to call her parents?
That's right, Mr. Green.
So instead, my daughter, who was possibly raped, just suffered in silence.
There are guidelines. We have to follow them.
That was crap. And when this was over, Simon would do what he could to get payback. But right now, he had to focus on the task at hand. He didn't want to. He wanted to collapse and cry for his daughter. So is that when Paige started to spiral?
Van de Beek thought it over. His answer surprised him.
No, not really. I know how that sounds, but the next time I saw her, which was when?
A few days later. Paige showed up in class. She seemed better. I remember standing behind the lectern and looking at her, a little surprised to see her. And she gave me this nod like, I'm okay, don't worry about it. A few days later, she started coming to office hours again. I can't tell you how thrilled I was to see her. I tried to raise the topic, but she said it was no big deal, that she overreacted. I'm not saying she was totally fine. I could see that she was trying to block. I urged her to get help, to talk to someone. One of the hardest parts is that the girls are still on the same campus as their alleged attacker.
Rapist.
What?
Don't call him an alleged attacker. Call him a rapist.
I don't know what he was.
But you know who, right?
He stood there.
You do, don't you?
She didn't tell me.
But you know the name of the boy.
He looked off. I have a guess. At least I do now.
What does that mean?
Van de Beek put his hand through his thick hair and let loose a long breath. This is where the story takes a bizarre turn, Mr. Green.
Like it hasn't already, Simon thought.
I don't know the order, Van de Beek continued. I'm not sure what came first, Paige's deterioration or... He stopped.
Or what?
There was another... He paused, looked up as though searching for the right word.
Incident on campus.
Incident, Simon repeated.
Yes. Do you mean rape?
Van de Beek winced. Paige didn't use the word rape, never, just for the record.
Now, Simon knew, was not the time to get into a semantics debate. Was there another assault?
Yes.
Was it done by the same boy?
He shook his head. Just the opposite.
Meaning?
The boy, I believe, may have assaulted Paige, Van de Beek said, his words coming more measured now. He was the victim this time. He met Simon's gaze. Simon did not blink. His name is Doug Mulzer, a sophomore econ major from Pittsburgh. He was beaten with a baseball bat after a frat party on campus. Broken legs. And then, the smaller end of the bat
It was... He started to stammer. Well, that part of the attack was never made public. The family didn't want it known, but the rumors spread around campus. He's still convalescing in Pittsburgh. Simon could feel the chill work its way up his spine. And do you think Paige had something to do with this? He opened his mouth, closed it, tried again. Simon could see that he was straining to be careful with his words. I can't say for sure, but in class the next day, Paige just kept smiling. Everyone else was upset over what had happened, but Paige kept staring at me and grinning in this weird way, and I could see for the first time that she was glassy-eyed, like she was on something, like she was high.
So your evidence is that she got high and smiled? Simon asked. Maybe she got high to numb the pain.
Vanderbeek said nothing. I don't care what she was on, Simon said, picturing the sickening assault in his head. Paige wouldn't do something like that.
I agree.
Another student walked by and shouted out a, Hi, Lewis! And Vanderbeek gave him an absent-minded nod.
She wouldn't do something like that. At least not on her own.
Simon froze. But when Paige left class that day, I noticed that there was a man waiting for her, not a kid, not a student. A man, I'd guess, was about 10 years older. Aaron, Simon thought. It was Aaron.
Chapter 31.
All the info I just gave you, you can't tell anyone, Elena had said. Someone could claim that it was obtained illegally, the fruits of a bad act or some such thing. Either way, even if we go to the feds today, it won't be a priority. It'll take days, probably weeks, just to get it assigned to someone. We don't have...
Elena heard a click on her line. Another call was coming in. The caller ID was blocked. Most people would suspect that it was some kind of spam call, but Lou had arranged something on the phones to prevent that. If she got a call, it was usually something relevant. And the last person she had given her card to was Allison Mayflower.
Simon, hold on. I have another call. She clicked over. Hello?
Hi. A woman's whisper. Not Allison Mayflower. This woman sounded young, 20s, maybe 30s.
Is this Miss Ramirez?
This is she. Who's this?
Oh, my name isn't important.
Could you speak up?
Sorry. I'm a little nervous. I'm calling for a friend of mine. You met her today at a certain cafe.
Go on.
She needs to see you. Boy, does she need to see you, but she's afraid.
Allison Mayflower, Elena recalled, lived with another woman named Stephanie Mars. Could be her on the line.
I understand, Elena said in her gentlest voice. Maybe we can meet someplace where she'd feel comfortable.
Yes, Allison really wants that.
Can you hold on just one split second?
Okay.
Elena moved fast. Simon?
Yeah, what's up?
Gotta go. Allison Mayflower wants to meet.
Elena clicked back over.
I know where you two live. I can drive.
No!
The young-sounding woman said in a panicked hush.
They'll follow you. Don't you see?
Elena actually put up a calming hand, which of course made no sense when you're on the phone.
Okay, sure, I see.
They're watching you.
They're watching us.
The woman sounded more than a little paranoid, but then again, at least 3 people were dead.
No worries, Elena said, keeping her tone even and casual.
Let's make a plan, something you two are both comfortable with.
It took about 10 minutes for them to come up with something that seemed to pacify the caller. Elena would take an Uber to the Cracker Barrel old country store near Route 95. She would stand out front. Stephanie, she finally said her name out loud, would flash her lights twice and drive up.
What kind of car will you be driving? Elena had asked.
I'd rather not say, just in case. Elena would then get in the car and be taken to see Allison at a secret location. Yes, Stephanie actually used the phrase secret location.
Come alone, Stephanie said.
I will. I promise.
If we see someone is following you, we're calling it off.
They agreed that Stephanie would call and ring once as a signal that she was set up at the Cracker Barrel. When they were off the phone, Elena sat on the bed and Googled Stephanie Mars. Nothing much came up. Elena changed into her other blue blazer, the one with a little more space for a holster and gun. She thought about calling Simon back, but chose instead to send a text letting him know that she hoped to meet with Allison Mayflower soon. Her phone was charging. She let Lou know that she'd be going out for a meet. Lou had put a high-end tracker on her phone so the home office could know her location if need be 24/7. An hour passed before the blocked number called again. Elena waited. One ring and a hang-up. The signal. Elena had been constantly checking her rideshare apps. One showed a car 8 minutes away. It arrived in 15. The Cracker Barrel in South Portland had the same faux rustic exterior that they all did. The front porch held a plethora of rocking chairs, all empty. Elena stood and waited. It didn't take long. A vehicle flashed its beams at her. Elena surreptitiously took a photo of the car, making sure she got the license plate, and sent it to Lou. Just in case. You never know. When the car pulled up, Elena opened the passenger door and looked inside. The driver was an attractive young woman wearing a Red Sox baseball cap.
Stephanie, please get in, quickly.
Elena wasn't the most agile, so it took a little time. As soon as she was seated, even before the door was fully closed, Stephanie Mars hit the accelerator.
Do you have a phone? Stephanie asked.
Yes.
Put it in the glove compartment.
Why?
This is just between you and Allison. No recordings, no calls, no texts.
I'm not sure I'm comfortable with giving up my phone.
Stephanie hit the brake.
Then we call this off right now.
You're carrying a gun, right?
Elena didn't answer.
Put your gun in the glove compartment, too. I don't know if you work for them or not.
Who is them?
Now, please.
One of the adopted boys is missing. I work for his father.
And we're just supposed to take your word on that?
The young woman shook her head in disbelief.
Please put your phone and gun in the glove compartment. You can have them back after you talk to Allison.
No choice. Elena took out her phone and gun. She popped open the glove compartment in front of her, dropped them inside, and closed it again. It wouldn't take long to retrieve them if there was an emergency. Elena studied Stephanie Mars's profile. She had red to auburn hair, probably cut short, hard to say for sure, with that baseball cap on, and was, in a word, beautiful. High cheekbones, flawless skin. She kept both hands on the wheel at 10 and 2, focusing hard on the road, as though she were new to driving.
Before I let you see Allison, I need to ask you a few questions.
Okay, Elena said.
Who exactly hired you?
Elena was going to say that she was not at liberty to divulge, but her client had already told her that it would be okay, that he didn't care who knew.
Sebastian Thorpe. He adopted a boy he named Henry.
And Henry is missing?
That's right.
Any clue where he is?
That's what I'm working on.
I don't understand.
Don't understand what?
How old is Henry Thorpe?
24.
How could his adoption have anything to do with his life now?
It might not.
She's a good person, you know. Allison, I mean. She'd never hurt anyone.
And I don't want to hurt her, Elena said.
I only want to find my client's son, but that's the thing. If Allison did do something illegal, she'd never.
I know. But if something about these adoptions was not completely by the book, and if she doesn't cooperate, well, then it's on her. All the walls come crashing down.
That sounds like a threat.
It's not meant to. It's meant to convey the severity of the situation. I'm Allison's best chance to do the right thing and stay out of legal trouble. Stephanie Mars regripped the steering wheel, her hands shaking.
I don't know what's best.
I don't want to hurt either one of you.
Do you promise you won't tell anyone about this?
Elena couldn't really make that promise. It depended on what Allison Mayflower said. Still, a small deception at this stage was the least of her worries right now.
Yes, I promise.
The car veered to the right.
Where is she? Elena asked.
My Aunt Sally has a summer cabin.
The younger woman actually managed to smile.
It's where Allison and I first met. They're friends, Aunt Sally and Allison. So see, my aunt has a barbecue to open the season every year, and 6 years ago, Allison and I were both invited. I know she's older than I am, but, well, you've seen her. She's young in so many ways. We met by the grill in the backyard. She makes the best skirt steak. Allison, I mean. And we started talking, and she shrugged, smiled, sneaked a glance at Elena.
That was it.
Sounds nice, Elena said.
You have someone?
The pang. Always the pang.
No, Elena said. Then she added, I used to, but he died.
Elena couldn't say why she told her that. Could be a subconscious ploy to bond. Could be that she just felt it needed to be said.
His name was Joel.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
We're almost there. They pulled into the drive. At the end of it, there was a log cabin. The genuine article, not the snap-together look or faux Cracker Barrel-type situation. Elena couldn't help but smile.
Aunt Sally has good taste.
Yeah, she does.
Is she here?
Sally? No. She's still in Philly, won't be up for months. I come here on my own once a week, kind of like a caretaker. No one really knows about the place, and you can see cars coming a mile away, so Allison thought it'd be safe.
She put the car into park and looked at Elena with her big eyes.
We're putting our trust in you. Come on.
As they got out of the car, two words came to mind. Green and quiet. Elena took in a deep breath of seriously fresh air.
Nice.
Her leg ached. That old wound, her constant companion. Stephanie Morris had told her about her initial chance encounter with Allison at a barbecue here. Fate. Destiny. Chaos. However two souls get thrown together. Joel loved to tease that he and Elena had the best meet-cute in history, and while she'd wave him off, maybe Joel was right. During a raid on a white supremacist militia compound outside Billings, Montana, Elena had been shot in the high upper leg, a nicer way of saying ass. The shot didn't hurt as much as you might think, at least not right away. It was more embarrassing than painful. And Elena, being one of the rare Hispanic women on the job, had felt as though she'd let down herself and her people. It was at the nearby hospital while she was recovering, her butt propped up on one of those inflatable tire-like devices, so there was no undue pressure on her wound, that Special Agent Joel Marcus first came into her room, and boom, into her life. Little did I know, Joel often joked, how much I'd enjoy seeing that ass up in the air in the future. She half smiled at the memory as Stephanie pushed open the door and called out, Allison! Honey! No answer. Without conscious thought, Elena started reaching for her piece, but of course, it was back in the car. Stephanie Mars hurried inside the house. Elena came through the door right behind her. Stephanie veered left and moved faster. Elena turned her head in that direction and was about to follow. But the younger woman had stopped moving. She slowly turned back toward Elena. The younger woman's beautiful face broke into a smile, just as Elena felt something cold press against the back of her skull. Their eyes met, Elena's sad brown and the young woman's wild green. And Elena knew. She thought of Joel when she heard the click and hoped, in the moment before the gun exploded, that she'd be with him again.
Chapter 32. Ash stood over Elena's dead body. She'd landed face down, head turned to the side at an unnatural angle, eyes open. Blood flowed out of the back of her head, but Ash had already put down a tarp to make cleanup easier. Dee Dee put a hand on his arm and squeezed. He looked up at her and saw that smile.
A man knows his great love's various smiles. That was what they said. The smile when she was happy, or the smile when she was genuinely laughing, or the smile when she peered into the eyes of the man she loved. All that. Ash knew this smile. The smile she saved for extreme violence. And he didn't like it.
"Is it different for you?"
Dee Dee asked him. "Killing a woman instead of a man?" Ash was not in the mood. "Where's her phone?" "It's still in the glove compartment." Ash had put a battery-operated jamming device in the glove compartment, so if someone was tracking her whereabouts, and he suspected that they might be, they'd be getting a no signal. "Pull the car around back and bring me the phone." Dee Dee put her hands on either side of his face. "You okay, Ash?"
"I'm fine, but we have to move fast."
She gave him a quick kiss on the cheek and hurried outside. Ash started to wrap the body in the tarp. They'd already dug a hole so that no one would find her. When Dee Dee brought him Elena's phone, he would send out a few "I'm fine" texts to anyone looking for her. It would take a few days, probably more, before someone started seriously investigating Elena Ramirez's disappearance. By then, Ash and Dee Dee would be done with the jobs. There'd be no clues. "Ironic," Dee Dee had said when Ash told her the plan. And while the actual meaning of the word ironic seemed elusive to Ash, he remembered people saying that Alanis Morissette had gotten it wrong in that song. It seemed to fit here. Elena Ramirez had been hired to find a missing Henry Thorpe, but Thorpe had been dead the whole time. And now, Elena Ramirez would be missing, too. Dee Dee came back into the house with the phone and jammer. "Here you go." Finished wrapping her up. She mock-saluted him.
"You're in a mood."
Ash bent down next to the body and picked up Elena's hand. There should still be enough electrical impulse traveling through her body so that her thumb could still unlock her phone. He pressed the phone against the pad. Bingo. The phone's wallpaper was a photograph of Elena smiling widely, her arms wrapped around a far taller man who was smiling just as wide. Dee Dee looked over his shoulder.
"Do you think that's her Joel?"
"I'd suspect so, yes." Ash had listened to the whole conversation in the car because Dee Dee kept her phone on. "Do you even have an Aunt Sally?" he asked her.
"No."
He shook his head in amazement. "You're good.
Do you remember our middle school production of West Side Story?"
Ash had worked building the sets. She'd been one of the Sharks girls.
"I should have been Maria. I killed the audition, but Mr. Orloff gave it to Julia Ford because her father owned that Lexus dealership."
Dee Dee didn't say this with anger or pity. She was being accurate. Ash was enamored, no doubt about it, but Dee Dee had real star quality. You could just see it. Everyone in the auditorium, even though she'd just been in the chorus, couldn't take their eyes off her. Dee Dee could have been a great actress, a big star. But what kind of break was she, a foster beauty constantly fending off male adults, going to get? His tone was tender. "You were great in that play, Dee Dee." She worked on the tarp now, wrapping it around the body. "I mean it. Thank you, Ash." He clicked on the settings key and then found the privacy icon. From there, he tapped location services and scrolled all the way to the bottom to where it said system services. He scrolled again and found significant locations. When he pressed to see it, the screen asked for the thumb again. He grabbed Elena's and used it. Then he changed the password so he can get in without the thumb next time. People don't realize how much of their privacy they casually give away. On any iPhone at any time, you could do what Ash was doing now. See the complete history of where the phone's owner, in this case Elena Ramirez, had recently visited.
"Damn," he said.
"What?"
"She's been to the tattoo parlor."
"We had to figure that was a possibility, Ash. That's why we had to act fast." He checked through the list of locations and saw several spots in New York City. Most recently, Elena Ramirez had been at Columbia Medical Center near 168th Street. Ash wondered why. Then he noticed something more troubling. "She's been to the Bronx." Dee Dee finished tying the rope around the tarp. "Same location?" He clicked it and nodded.
Oh, that's not good, Dee Dee said.
We have to hurry.
He scanned through her phone log and texts. The most recent text, coming in 8 minutes ago, read, "Have you met with Allison yet? Please fill me in when you can."
Dee Dee saw the look on his face.
What is it?
Someone else is getting close.
Who?
Ash flipped the phone around so Dee Dee could read the screen. We're going to have to do something about a guy named Simon Green. Chapter 33.
Simon collapsed into a seat on the subway. He stared out the window across the car without focusing, letting the underground whiz by in a hazy blur. He tried to comprehend what he'd just learned. Nothing made sense. He'd gotten more pieces to the puzzle, important pieces, perhaps even an explanation of what had started his daughter's spiral into drug addiction. But the more pieces he got, the less clear the final image was becoming. When he got back up onto the street, a text came in from Yvonne. "Money is ready. You'll need to sign for it. Ask for Todd Raish." The bank was located between a Wendy's and a high-end bakery. There was no line and just one teller. He gave his name and asked to speak to Todd Raish. Raish was all professional. He showed Simon into a back room. "Are hundreds okay?" he asked. Simon said that they were. Raish counted out the money. "Would you like a bag for that?" Simon had his own, a plastic bag Ingrid had saved from a recent trip to Zabar's. He put the cash in that and then jammed the bag into his backpack. He thanked Raish and started on his way. As he headed up Broadway toward the hospital, Simon called Randy Spratt, the genetics tech. When he answered, Simon said, "I have the money."
10 minutes.
He hung up. Simon checked to see if there were any messages yet from Elena Ramirez. Nothing. It was probably too soon, but he sent a quick text anyway. "Have you met with Allison yet? Please fill me in when you can." No immediate reply. No dancing dots indicating an answer was forthcoming. Simon kept staring at his phone as he walked, mostly to distract himself from this upcoming rendezvous. He'd rushed himself on the paternity test, panicked even, without really considering the repercussions. But now that he had a second or two, now that the answer was about to, like it or not, slap him in the face, he wondered, what would he do if he learned the worst? Suppose he wasn't Paige's biological father. Suppose he wasn't Sam's or Anya's father either. Slow down, he told himself. But there was really no time to slow down, was there? The truth, one way or the other, was barreling toward him like a freight train. He still really couldn't fathom it. For one thing, Sam looked just like him. Everyone said so. And though he couldn't see it himself, could any parents, he knew. He knew what? It simply wasn't possible. Ingrid would never do that to him. And yet that small, niggling voice taunted him. He remembered reading some statistic that 10% of fathers are unknowingly raising another man's child. Or was it really 2%? Or was that all nonsense? When Simon reached the clearing behind the pediatric wing, Randy Spratt was already on a bench in the corner. Spratt sat upright with his hands jammed deep in the pockets of his trench coat, his gaze darting about like a scared rodent. Simon sat next to him. The two men stared straight ahead.
"You got the money?" Spratt whispered.
"This isn't a ransom drop, you know. Do you have it or not?" Simon reached into his backpack for the plastic bag. He hesitated. He didn't have to go through with opening this particular Pandora's box. Maybe ignorance was bliss in some cases, no? He'd lived happily without knowing Ingrid's secret past. Right. And look where that had brought them. Simon handed over the cash. For a second, he feared that Spratt would count it right there and then, but the plastic bag quickly disappeared into the trench coat.
"Well?" Simon asked.
"The one you said was a priority. The yellow toothbrush." Simon felt his mouth go dry. "Yes. I rushed that one, so it's the only result I have with a scientifically definitive conclusion."
Interesting that Spratt hadn't told him that before he got paid. But maybe that didn't matter.
And what's the conclusion? Simon asked.
It's positive.
What does that mean?
You're the biological father.
Relief. Sweet relief flooded Simon's lungs and veins.
And for what it's worth, even though the results are only preliminary, all indications are that you're the biological father for all three.
Without another word, Randy Spratt rose and walked away. Simon just sat there, unable to move. He watched an old woman wearing the standard-issue hospital smock and leaning on a walker make her way to a flower bed. She bent down and smelled the flowers, both literally and metaphorically. Simon did the latter by just sitting there and watching. A group of young medical residents sat on the grass and ate gyros from a nearby food truck. They all looked both frayed and happy, like Ingrid did during her residency, when she worked ridiculous hours but knew that she was one of the lucky few who found her calling. Being a physician, Simon knew, was indeed a calling. Weird thought, but there you go. Or maybe not so weird. Simon had recently learned that Paige had shared her mother's calling. Under normal circumstances, it would mean the world to him. In some ways, it still did. He had to find her. He checked his phone, hoping to see something from Elena Ramirez. No new message. He typed her another one. DNA test shows I'm Paige's father. Still don't know how she hooked up with Aaron, but I think it's about the illegal adoptions. Call me when you finish with Allison Mayflower. It was time to head back to Ingrid's room. He stood up, tilted his face to the sky, closed his eyes. He just needed another moment or two. He and Ingrid had taken a few yoga classes as a marital bonding thing, and the instructor had been all about the importance of breathing. So he took a deep inhale, held it, let it out slowly. Didn't help. He felt his phone vibrate. Elena was replying. Heading over the border to Canada for this meet, so I might be out of touch for a few days. Where will you be?
Canada? He wasn't sure what to make of that.
He typed, at hospital for now. But that could change. He hit send and waited. The dancing dots started up, showing that Elena was typing. Let me know of any new developments. It's vital to keep me in the loop, even if I can't reply.
Simon wrote back that he would as he checked in with hospital security and took the elevator up to the ICU. He was tempted to ask Elena why Canada, or why she might not be able to reply, but he figured that she'd tell him what he needed to know. As the elevator doors opened, the terrible ache from what Van de Beek had told him returned tenfold. What had happened to Paige on that campus?
Block, he told himself, block, or you won't be able to take another step.
The nurses were in with Ingrid, bathing her and changing her clothes, so Sam paced the corridor. He spotted his father and gave him a quick, hard hug.
Sorry, Sam said.
It's okay.
I didn't mean it. About you getting Mom shot.
I know.
Sam gave his father a weary smile. You know what Mom would say if she heard me blame you?
What?
She'd say I was being sexist. She'd say I would never have blamed her if you got shot.
Simon liked that. You know what? I think you're right.
Where were you? Sam asked.
Simon wanted to protect his son, only natural. But he also didn't want to coddle him.
I just talked to one of Paige's professors.
Sam looked at him. He used the vaguest terms possible to let Sam know about the sexual assault. He may not want to coddle, but he didn't want to just chuck his son in the deep end either. Sam listened without interrupting. He fought to remain stoic, but Simon recognized the telltale quiver of his lower lip.
When was this exactly?
Sam asked when his father had finished. I'm not sure. Toward the end of the first semester.
She called me one night, Paige, out of the blue. I mean, I don't think we'd exchanged more than a few texts, and we never called each other.
What did she say?
She just said she wanted to talk.
About?
I don't know.
Sam gave a too big shrug.
It was late on a Friday night. There was a party at Martin's. I didn't really listen. I just wanted to get her off the line, so yeah, that's what I did.
Simon put his hand on his son's shoulder.
It might not have been the same night, Sam.
Right, Sam said in the most unconvincing voice he could muster.
Might not have been.
Simon was about to follow up more, but he heard someone clear his throat. He turned and was surprised to see the man who saved Ingrid's life standing behind him.
Cornelius?
He still wore the ripped jeans and the unruly white-gray beard.
How's Ingrid doing? Cornelius asked.
Hard to say. Simon brought Sam into the fold. Sam, this is Cornelius.
Simon couldn't tell him that Cornelius had shot Luther and thus saved not just Ingrid, but Simon as well.
Cornelius owns the building where Paige lived in the Bronx. He's been a big help to us.
Sam stuck out his hand.
Nice to meet you.
You too, young man. Cornelius faced Simon. Can I talk to you a second?
Sure. I need to use the bathroom anyway, Sam said before moving down the corridor.
Simon turned to Cornelius. What's up?
I need you to come with me, Cornelius said.
Where?
Back to my apartment. Rocco is going to be there. With Luther. They got something you need to hear.
Chapter 34 Ash and Dee Dee had prepared, so they moved fast. They tossed Elena's body in a wheelbarrow by the back door. Ash maneuvered the wheelbarrow into the woods, while Dee Dee stayed at the cabin and finished the cleanup. Digging a hole takes a while. Filling it in, not so much. As they drove south, Dee Dee kept going through Elena's phone.
Not much here, she told Ash. Elena Ramirez is a bigwig at VMB Investigations, we already knew that. Her client was Henry Thorpe's father, we already knew that. She looked up. It's approved, by the way.
What's approved?
Simon Green. You'll be given the same payment as the others.
Google him, Ash said. I want to see what we can learn.
She started typing. It didn't take long. The PPG Wealth Management Group website came up, complete with Simon Green's biography.
There were two photos of him, a headshot and a group picture with the entire PPG team.
They passed the state line.
12% battery left, Dee Dee said. Do we have a charger for this kind of phone?
Check the pocket behind my seat.
Dee Dee was just stretching to do that when Elena's phone vibrated. A new message came in from Simon Green. She read it out loud to Ash.
DNA test shows I'm Paige's father. Still don't know how she hooked up with Aaron, but I think it's about the illegal adoptions. Call me when you finish with Allison Mayflower.
Ash asked her to read it again. Then he said, if we don't answer him, he may start to worry about Elena Ramirez and make calls.
How about, she started typing, heading over the border to Canada for this meet, so I might be out of touch for a few days. Where will you be?
Ash nodded. Dee Dee stared at the screen as Ash hit the accelerator.
He's typing a reply, she said.
We should probably get off the messaging app when you're done with this.
Why?
There might be a way to trace it, I don't know.
The phone vibrated again. At hospital for now, but that could change.
Hospital, Dee Dee repeated. Should I ask which one?
No, he'll get suspicious. And besides, we know already. Elena's history had recent visits to one in Upper Manhattan.
Good point. How about...
She typed it up and then read it out loud to him.
Let me know of any new developments. It's vital to keep me in the loop, even if I can't reply.
Ash nodded and told her to hit send. She did.
Now shut it down.
They drove in silence for a few minutes before Dee Dee said,
What?
You know what?
I really don't.
Simon Green's text, Ash said.
What about it?
I assume the Aaron is Aaron Corval.
I assume the same.
So who's Paige?
Aaron's girlfriend, right?
Why would her father be involved?
I don't know.
Didi turned toward him, tucking her feet under her butt.
I thought you didn't care about the whys, Ash.
I normally don't.
You didn't like killing that woman, Didi said. Men are fine to kill, but a woman? Will you stop? It's not that. Then what?
Someone connected the dots. That makes the motives and details my business now. Didi turned.